Hey, it's me, Brian Reeves. Have you ever considered working with a coach? Like maybe you've achieved success on the outside, but deep fulfillment is still missing inside? Or you're confronted with a massive challenge or choice in your life? Or your relationships aren't as fulfilling as you want them to be? Or maybe you're just tired of trying to figure life out all by yourself? Well, I invite you to apply for private one-on-one coaching with me. Since 2012, I've helped 1,000 men and women like you break through hidden barriers, deepen their relationships, especially the relationship with themselves, and step more fully into the life they were meant to live. Coaching isn't about getting advice. It's about deep transformation so that you can really hear and trust the wisdom and clarity already always within you. I only take on a few clients at a time, and I only work with men and women truly ready to do the work. So if you're up for an inner adventure as a pathway to meaningful change in your outer world, go to brianreeves.com/coaching, click an application link on that page to apply. That's Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, reeves.com/coaching. The breakthrough you need could begin today. All right, let's get into today's episode.
I think just turned 40 and everything was good, just like you were describing. I had a family, I had a young son, I was house on the hill. Everything was beautiful and I was dying inside. Mm-hmm. There was a slow suffocation that was happening inside me, a depression that was borderline suicidal. And the defeat saved my life, because it was the only point at which I was finally able to say, I need help. And that's when I surrendered and asked three men to do a ritual for me, mm-hmm. to help me get out of this grave that I was digging every day.
Welcome to Men This Way, the podcast for every man who seeks to live his deepest purpose in life, who's committed to showing up fully and giving his unique gifts to the world. Because if not you, then who? I'm your host and fellow journeyman, Brian Reeves. Brian with a Y, Reeves. Men, this way. Welcome to Men This Way. I'm your host, Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, Reeves, and alongside me as co-host is my lifelong childhood best friend of over 40 years, Tate Arend. Together we dive deep into the challenges and opportunities that we're all facing in the world today. You can expect real, raw, unfiltered conversations around the topics that matter most to us. Intimacy, purpose, family, spirituality, and so much more. Our mission? To reveal wisdom, insights, and practical tools that can empower us and you to live life skillfully, masterfully. Today's guest is Francis Weller, a soul-centered psychotherapist, a true wise elder, and author of one of the most beautiful and heart-wrenching books I've ever read, The Wild Edge of Sorrow. A few years ago, he helped me discover that I've been sitting on a lifetime of grief, and that my inability to access and process that grief, or even recognize it's there, has had a profound impact on the quality of my relationships and of my life. It's just me and Francis today, and our conversation is rich and profound. I always love speaking with Francis Weller. May it serve you well. All right, let's dive. Francis Weller, sir, welcome to Men This Way.
Glad to be here with you, Brian. Thanks for inviting me.
Francis, your work has touched an immensity in me. You have medicine. You are a medicine carrier in ways that few of my, certainly the elders and even many of the teachers I've studied, not trying to compare, but I just want to say thank you, Francis, for being here.
I'm very touched by those words, Brian. I'm glad that the path that I have been called to has found some resonance out there in the world. And I can see by and hear by your words that it's landed in you in a good way, which is meaningful for me. I mean,
yeah.
You keep me spiritually employed.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. I know that. Yes. Yes, I can relate to that very much. And you know, it's only in the last, you know, 7-8 years, I think since I approached 40 and entered my 40s, that I started to realize, wait a second, I don't really have elders. I don't know if it's Bill Plotkin, somebody this makes this distinction between olders and elders. And I realized, you know, within the last 10 years, I don't really have elders. I have a few, and the ones I have they seem to be women that I really look up to as elders, like people showing me the way into the life my soul feels it was born to live through this body. And I think, as you know, as a man especially, I look to you, I look at your work, I as I've spent much time with you and your offerings over the past, you know, it was one of my coaching clients, a man who brought you to me. And one of the greatest gifts I've ever been given. Mm. So I see you, you know, I look to you as an elder, and you are a rare commodity, sadly, in my experience. And I think in a lot of our listeners, men and women, I think they'll be able to relate to that as well. So it's a privilege to sit here with you today.
Thank you.
You know, I want to start, there's a starting point for our conversation, and we've already begun. And I know that I'm talking a lot, and I want to shut up and let you talk, but also, you know, it's crazy. Like as a younger, feeling unseen by the elders, here I am sitting with an elder. There's that part of me that's like, see me, guide me, help me. Like that's part of the pounding in my chest is the as a man in his mid 40s, longing for the elder man particularly to say, you know, look at the name of my podcast, Men This Way. Let me start here, because you said something that, you know, I've often remarked as a coach myself, and I've worked with couples for many years and men and women now, and you said men don't show up voluntarily. They show up because they have been defeated.
Yes.
And I think you were sharing this in the context of who shows up in your therapy office primarily.
Yes.
And I sat with that, and I, you know, I've reflected on this even myself. Like, I'm a man who's been on some level committed to personal growth work for decades. I've done all the transformational workshops. I've done, you know, psychedelics for the purpose of awareness and insight. I have a master's degree in human relations. Like, I've studied with teachers. Like, I've done all this stuff, and yet I'm aware that the times in my life when I really showed up, Francis, were the times when indeed something in life had fully defeated me.
Mm-hmm.
And I could no longer just rely on book knowledge, you know, or a smart intellect. So I'm curious, you know, why do you suppose, so two questions in this, why do you suppose it takes that for us men to be defeated before we really show up, like to hit some bottom? And I'm really interested to know about you personally as a man, a time in your life when you were finally fully defeated and that called you to then really show up in a new way.
Okay, first part, you know, all of the striving we do to improve, to get better, to be more spiritual, more awake, more, you know, aware, those are all good pursuits, but they oftentimes get kind of tangled up with a heroic pursuit, you know, somehow making ourselves better. Oftentimes means I leave behind huge parts of me, the weakness, the inadequacy, the shame, the lonely one, all the inferior brothers, the outcast brothers. And there's no real arrival into soul without them. Mm-hmm. There's an arrival into self-improvement, you know, self-mastery. Mm-hmm. So we have to make a little distinction between self and soul. Mm-hmm. Self is the presentation of my identity to the world. Soul is what animates that identity. But if I'm so busy improving the self, oftentimes I neglect the soul. Mm-hmm. And soul takes us into the vulnerable, into grief, into loss, you know, into our own tender ground. And that's why defeat comes along periodically and throws us to the ground, into the depths, into confusion, into bewilderment, into shame. You know, we are thrown into that territory, not out of some, what would you call it, sadistic sense, but out of a necessity to weave that part into our being. Because like I say, there was no arrival. There's no even real true sense of belonging until the whole house comes with me. Not just the ideal parts, not just the successful, competent brothers, but also all of the weak ones, all of the ones that drool and don't know how to dress properly. And, you know, the ones we want to keep a little hidden because we are a heroic culture. And that imagery demands that we always show strength.
Yeah.
So we only get to show part of ourselves. And if that's the case, no man's going to walk into my office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's the image of strength.
Yeah.
But unless there's been a depression, an addiction, a divorce, loss of a job, an illness, death of someone close,
yeah,
that's when they crawl in the door. That's when they've been brought to the ground. And if we're lucky, we remain there. We remain close to the ground. Humility, not heroics, but humility is what binds us together. It makes us recognize the commonality that we all share. The heroic distinguishes us. The humility entangles us with one another.
You talk a lot about this heroic culture, and I think I first heard you use that term to identify that. And that really, really spoke to me, especially in these last many years as I've been, you know, okay, I'm a white man, 47 years old. I'm a white man. I've pretty much gotten everything that this culture says is coming to me.
Mm-hmm.
I got the woman. I got the work. I'm making money. I'm successful. I have admiration. I have, you know, just, I'm not in the 0.1%, but I'm probably in the 1%. And holy shit, Francis, all of a sudden, what now? Sort of happened to me in the last, you know, 3-4 years. Like, oh my God, I don't know. What now? You know, I think your work came to me. Look, I wish it would have come to me 25 years ago, but here we are, you know, because grieving, you know, you talk about the heroic culture and what arises for me inside of that, you know, being defeated. Well, I got everything I wanted, more or less. I mean, I've been defeated in many ways over the years, and some, you know, usually at the hands of a woman or a relationship anyway, or running out of money at different times, whatever. But no, nothing major happened. Nobody died. You know, in my case, I wasn't sexually abused or assaulted or, you know, just, and so a part of me has been thinking, well, what do I have to grieve? You know, what do I have to, you know, why should I hurt? So my parents divorced at 4. So what? You know, no one beat me. So I grew up with alcoholism in my home at a young age. So what? I mean, I wasn't beaten. Nobody talked bad to me. And yet, Francis, in these last few years, I'm uncovering a mountain of grief and sadness and loss. And the heroic culture you speak of, there's no place for that.
No.
You know, you said something. Also, there are two illnesses in our modern world. Amnesia and anesthesia. I think a lot of our listeners will be able to relate to anesthesia in a sense, you know, the numbing out using whether it's money, you know, work, porn, video games, sex, TV, whatever, gambling, alcohol. What have we forgotten? What's the amnesia part of that? I know there's something, I feel it, I know it, you speak to it. What do you say about that?
I guess before we move too far into I want to just acknowledge your other question about my own defeat.
Ah, yes. Thank you for calling back to that. Yes.
Yeah, it was the time when the one that's coming to my mind, there's been multiple defeats as well, but I had, I think, just turned 40 and everything was good, just like you were describing. I had a family, I had a young son, I was house on the hill, everything was beautiful, and I was dying inside. There was a slow suffocation that was happening inside me, a depression that was borderline suicidal. And the defeat saved my life because it was the only point at which I was finally able to say, I need help. And that's when I surrendered and asked three men to do a ritual for me, mm-hmm. to help me get out of this grave that I was digging every day. Mm-hmm. That defeat, like the men who come into my office or come to the retreats and or do the initiation work, that defeat, if we're really candid about it, is the invitation towards some sense of connectivity again. Out of that isolation, the heroic is a very isolated archetype. It's a singular presence. Mm. You're above everything else. Mm. You need no one. The hero is basically independent and autonomous. It's the other parts of us that recognize how much I need other people. You know, when I did redefine weakness for men, that it's a weakness only says that the next step I take, I cannot take alone. That's all it says. Mm. It's not a commentary. It's not a commentary on your inadequacy or your worthlessness. It just says the next step requires support. Mm. But that's a shameful thing for a man to admit. So that's one of my personal moments of defeat.
And I've heard you tell this story, and I love this story. What did those three friends do?
They took me into a ritual process that radically shook my world. Yesterday was the anniversary of that, 25 years ago. They put me through an ordeal that part of the strategic mode of getting by in this culture is to pretend you always know what the fuck is going on. And they put me through a ritual where I couldn't pretend it anymore. I tried to figure out what they wanted from me in the ritual, like, well, they want me to fight, or they want me to... Uh-huh. And then, you know, and of course, those are empty gestures kind of conjured by my mind. But what I had to do is completely let go of all of that. And in my language, I had to become deranged.
Yeah.
I had to let go of control. And something in that moment, some radical transmission between this world and the other world occurred. And I saw exactly what I needed to do in that moment. And what I needed to do in terms of fighting for my life for the first time. See, I was a great accommodator. I knew what people wanted from me, and I was very good at giving people what they wanted. And that was my provisional sense of belonging.
Yeah.
But my depression was about never feeling like I belong. I could pretend like I did. I could give you what I thought would please you, then you would like me and approve of me. But that's not the belonging.
Yeah.
That's strategic manipulation. I had to somehow break through that fiction and come into something much more authentic, much more real. And that moment, I consider that like a December 2nd threshold moment between the first 40 years and the last 25 years are so radically different in terms of my presence. Mm-hmm. Everything that you were acknowledging before came out of that stepping into my life for the first time and occupying what soul was yearning to express, but never having a conduit for it because I was so preoccupied with fooling everybody.
I find it, and we'll come back to my other questions in a moment about amnesia and anesthesia, but I'm particularly struck by the format, you could say, of that, or the container of that experience. Three of your male friends created an ordeal for you.
Yeah.
One of the things that no one ever really told me, and that I didn't trust, I'm a former military guy, 10 years in the Air Force, was a captain in the Air Force, and I was in a fraternity in college. You know, I'm no stranger to men throughout most of my life. But what I found also is that I didn't trust men. Mm-hmm. I didn't trust them. I didn't feel safe around men, certainly not to be vulnerable. And yet now, later in my life, I find that I can't really feel deeply good about my life unless I have solid, trustable men around me regularly. And when I'm doing, you know, men's work, one way we call it. So I'm just struck by that in your storytelling, in your experience, that it was your male friends putting you through an ordeal that was mm-hmm. difficult and challenging and left you no out except I don't even know how the language to use, but through or surrender or letting go or being deranged, as you say.
Yeah.
To upend the previous arrangement.
Yeah, and then that takes a great deal of trust.
Yeah.
It also takes a great deal of familiarity. I had to be known that thoroughly on some level by these men to precisely design something. It wasn't cookie cutter. It wasn't, well, let's, you know, whatever. But it had to have the precision. Even the language that was spoken during that ritual landed so squarely at the heart of the trouble. But there was nothing I could do to evade, duck, to deny, to the only, like as we say, the only way out was through. And I'd still be on that hillside today if I hadn't. You were not going to let me go. It was a 7-hour ordeal, and I was wrecked by the end of it. Something shifted so profoundly inside of me of what I needed to, how I needed to kind of structure my life and to carry myself into the world. And
I'm struck by something that one of your friends said, Maladoma Somme. Did I pronounce his name right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think I read about this in Bill Plotkin's book, Nature and the Human Soul, about the initiation rites of passage that Maladoma Somme, in his culture, he spoke to, you know, their boys undergo an ordeal similarly. And it could be that sometimes they don't survive.
Right.
But that in their culture, they feel it, I don't know if this is the right language, but it's better that a boy not survive that ordeal than that than he live into adulthood without ever having undergone the ordeal. To be, I can't remember the exact language he used there, but I was, again, really struck by that. And how you're saying, like your friends, I know we're speaking a bit poetically, but would have left you on that hillside had you not been able to make that crossover.
Yeah, well, Maladoma is one of those men that was there.
Oh, I love that. Oh, man, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Three men who knew ritual.
Ah, yes.
So deeply in their bones that, but this ties us back into the amnesia piece.
Well, and he might have left you, so you're right. They might have left you there.
Yeah, they were definitely not going to rescue me.
I love it. Okay, thank you. That's really... That's good.
But this ties us into the amnesia in the sense of having spent some time in his culture, you see the consequence of a local culture that still remembers to some degree what's required to shape an adult human being. And when we forget that, when we abandon those practices, we end up with a collective of adolescents that are self-centered, self-interested, but not communally interested. See, initiation in the traditional sense was never meant for the individual. Mm. It was not about my personal growth. Mm. It wasn't about making me a better person, more admirable. Mm. It was an act of sacrifice on behalf of the community to which now the initiate is committed and is devoted. Mm. It was an act for the other. It was an act for the community. Now that's such a strange thought for us because everything's always about me. I go to therapy for me. I do spiritual workshops for me. But in the traditional sense, initiation was for the community. It was for the commons. It was for the watershed. It was for the cosmos, but it was not about you. And we have that completely twisted around. This is part of the amnesia.
Yeah.
When you forget the structures that create living culture, you're reduced to mimics of it. So we have personal growth rather than initiation. Mm-hmm. They're similar territory.
Right.
But the outcome is so radically different.
Yeah.
They almost separate in the long run.
I'm smiling and laughing because there's something, you know, my childhood bestie, I'm so blessed that I get to my childhood best friend. We've been friends for 37 years and we started facilitating men's work together. And we've created this year-long men's initiation program we call it Elevate. And one of the things that he'll often when he's talking to men who have applied and want to be a part of this, you know, he's a passionate man. He is a beautiful, beautiful man. I mean, he's one of the finest people I know on the planet. His name's Tate. And he'll often tell them, you need to know that this is not about you. you joining this program, this experience, this is not about you. You know, we'll often presence, you know, for whom does it matter that you're here in our work? And we'll say, this is not, and it's funny because I'll, Tate will tell me about these conversations. And I'll be like, Tate, you can't necessarily just say that. You have to tell them it is also for them. So I'm kind of laughing because, you know, there's that, our culture, like, I think on some level, these guys need to think that it is about them, but also it's not about them. You know, to the point you're, I think that, like, that's, that feels like soul language.
Well, there's no doubt that the process radically changes them.
Yeah.
I mean, the goal of initiation, if we can put that language on it, which is very,
yeah.
But if there's an intention behind initiation, part of it is to crack the identity open so that I am now part of the watershed. I am part willow and part turtle and part, you know, sky and part lichen. I become part of all that. And that's the intention, so that when something is happening to the watershed, it's felt in my bones. Mm-hmm. It quickens me to respond to protection towards service, rather than, again, my own internal world, which is beautiful. I love the work of the internal world, but what about the affiliation to the larger world?
You know, I see it, you know, even in the language we use to describe this, elevate 2022.
I was going to say something about that.
I see it, elevate.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think in your, you know, I've gone through a part of your, I'm still working on your Alchemy of Initiation course that you hosted recently, which again, just a revelation. I know that you led a year-long journey for men for 17 years.
Yes.
And you shared that for the first half of your journey was really a descent of sorts, an underworld's journey.
Yeah.
I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about that, how you helped steward men through the course of a year. What, because there's not a lot of things out there that I've ever been certainly part of or even seen that really do that, hold men for a year. And I'm doing it now, and I'm learning so much. I mean, I have as much to learn as I have to teach. I have more to learn than I have to teach. That's been part of my paralysis myself of doing men's work, is without elders showing me the way. Like, where the hell am I leading men?
Mm-hmm.
It's been a persistent, paralyzing question. Where the hell am I taking guys? I don't even know where I'm going. Where are we going? So, you know, I see elevate. I see it. I see it. Well, again, where are we going? So that it's a heroic term.
Yes.
And I see that.
Yeah. Well, good. I mean, that's really important to see how much it's always about rising. I mean, that's that heroic archetype right there. It's always about rising. Yeah, nothing wrong with that. Okay. It's a beautiful thing to grow and to get stronger. It's beautiful, but it leaves so much out.
Yeah.
So the first part of the initiation process was about shedding. You know, we call our work the making of ordinary men, because we're so conditioned to try to be special. You know, and that specialness comes out of a fractured sense of belonging. So if I don't belong, then I better impress the hell out of you. You know, so I have to be something more than. And I often talk about this image as, you know, like watching a falcon fly. God, they're beautiful, aren't they? But not a single falcon up there is trying to be a special falcon. They are just being themselves.
Yeah.
And when a creature is just itself, it is most beautiful. And when we're trying to be special, there is no exchange. The flow all comes towards me, and I offer nothing. So part of becoming an ordinary man is to get back into the exchange. Come back into the conversation with the living world. Yes, I have gifts to give. And yes, I am in need of gifts. But that exchange has to occur out of a mutuality. And so that making of ordinary men is part of that thinning out and shedding, letting go. I remember we were up in Oregon doing a year long with a group up there. And on the first night, we're sitting out under the moon. And I use that language, you know, that our work here is to make ordinary men of you. And a man, almost like he had springs in his butt, leapt off the ground and started screaming at me, I've spent my whole life trying to become special, and you're going to take that away from me? That's how desperately we cling to these identities, you know? And it's scary to let them go. Who will I be without that special identity of a perfect guy? I mean, in graduate school, I was called the Golden Boy. That was my nickname, you know? I was so polished and shiny, but inside it was so dead, cold. Yeah. So the first half of the year, we work in the underworld. The first weekend, we work with what we call the predator and grief. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we go into this territory of what is the main adversary that we really have to confront? What is this energy of death that we have made agreements with over and over again? To live small, to be good and nice boys, but never to find our authority and our presence in the world. We could spend several days unpacking this idea of predator. Yeah,
I know.
And then after you unpack that one and you see all the collusions and the ways in which you've lived partial lives, kind of backing your way into the grave without ever really arriving here, there's tremendous grief. So that first week that we're together, we do a confrontation with predator, which is what that ritual, those men did for me. That's what I saw in that ritual.
Okay.
Yeah. That I was in collusion with the energies of death, and I was dying every day. Mm-hmm. So we do a ritual that's really powerful, which I cannot describe to you. And then after that, we move into grief work. And the amount of grief that the men begin to share around having lived these provisional lives, trying to figure out what people expected from them. How do I fit in? How do I convince you to let me in? Another part of our amnesia, right? I mean, I was talking to Maladoma, and he was saying, you know, in our village, it's the job of the community, of the village, to impress into the body of every child that they are somebody worthy of belonging and that they care, they're carriers of gift. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, in our culture, we've turned that 180 degrees around, where it's up to me to convince you that I'm someone worthy of being tolerated. Mm. And we spend a lifetime, again, this is our adolescent pursuit, a lifetime trying to find the ways that we can manage exile or belonging.
Yeah.
And always living on that very thin edge between those two realities. So this is, again, part of what happens when we fall into amnesia and we forget these principles of living culture.
Well, I'm just lit up, and the follicles on my skin are on edge because I'm, you know, men, there's this pursuit of freedom, constantly freedom, more money, more status, more respect, more whatever, more likes, more admiration, to be special. There's no freedom in that. That is the ultimate entrapment. Yes. And as I'm hearing you describe, you know, the making of ordinary men, oh, what a release. What a fucking relief. I don't have to be special. Oh, I can just be.
Yes.
That's the fucking freedom that we're all ironically looking for through our social media status or our bank accounts or whatever. It's in the make. I'm just, you know, again, feeling in a visceral level, you know, what you speak and the way that you speak it and articulate it. And my heart breaks. This is, again, you know, my heart breaks.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we have to really acknowledge, particularly, you know, men in general, is the emptiness that we feel inside. Why do we pursue all those things you just mentioned? Status, rank, wealth, privilege, you know, dominance. Why do we pursue those things? Well, because there's a quality of emptiness that we feel inside that is rooted in individualism and the absence of community. Mm. Individualism is a breeding ground for a feeling of emptiness. Mm. And we are addicted to individualism. Again, another aspect of that heroic template is you shall always be sovereign. You shall always be alone. You shall need no one. And so in the absence of what we really crave, which is community, you know, sharing ritual together, grieving together, saying thank you together, dancing together, singing together, sharing meals together, dreams, you know, stories. Those are the things that we really long for. It isn't about what's on TV tonight.
Yeah.
Or the latest cell phone. What we crave are what I call the primary satisfactions, the things that shaped us over hundreds of thousands of years. And this is where that amnesia really reaches its pinnacle. We've lost the primary satisfactions, and we are a culture addicted to the secondary satisfactions. That's why we are the highest consuming culture on the planet. We make up, what, 5% of the population, something like that? I don't even remember, but we consume almost 25% of the goods of the world. What is wrong? And you can never get enough of what you don't need. And that is not the very essence of addiction, right? You want more and more and more. So we have millionaires and billionaires craving more. Like they don't have enough. But there can never be enough if you're not addressing the core issue, which is this emptiness. I was in a racism workshop some years back in Berkeley, and we were going around the circle introducing ourselves, and just by the circle, I was the last one to share. And when it was my turn, I said, you know, one of the things I'm really looking at is this question of emptiness. And a Black man literally jumped out of his chair and pointed at me and said, that's it. Until your people address this issue, you'll continue to kill from us and steal from us every fucking day. Mm. And it just was like this, okay, I get it. That is my spiritual responsibility, to dig into this hole, weep into this hole, and help other people understand that they're living in this hole that can never be filled by things. The opposite of emptiness is not fullness. It is presence. It's entanglement. It's embodiment. That's the opposite of emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's not more. It's engagement, you know. That's what the initiation is really about. So that first half a year is really about kind of cracking open the conditioned shell of a man's psyche, according to Western civilization, white Western civilization.
Yeah.
And kind of unmasking that and seeing the cost of that. Yeah. And then we dive deep into the quality and character of their wounds. And through that lens of the wound, they begin to catch a glint of what their medicine might look like. And then we work with love and power. How do those two dynamics exchange with one another, fulfill each other, rather than choosing one or the other? You know, a lot of us are nice boys, so we think we can choose love. And then Jung would say that our power then goes into the shadow. Mm. Or conversely, we choose power, and then he said then our love goes into the shadow. But we need both.
Yeah,
we need power that's infused with love, and we need love that's potent, that has vitality behind it. Love has to become not maudlin, but robust. To love our world, our children, or the generations to come, that requires a love that isn't, you know, saccharine or sentimentalized.
Yeah, I like to say far less eloquently that it's not about choosing between heart or brains and balls. It's about connecting our heart to our brains and our balls.
Yeah.
And I would really like to explore grieving with you, because that's what brought me to you, your book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow. Mm. And it's related to what it's a, you know, from what we're just exploring right now. I mean, the heartbreak that I experience regularly when I look into the world and see what we're doing, right? I think you or someone you quoted or someone, I don't remember where I get so many of my references these days, but you know, participating in this culture requires destroying the planet. To just participate, I have to destroy the planet. My heart breaks every day when I look out. I have a beautiful view in my home here in Los Angeles, and I look out and what I see hurts me every day. It speaks to the amnesia and the anesthesia.
Yeah.
And your book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, Francis, and to all my listeners, it's one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. It's not a long book. It's not complicated, but it's gorgeous. Mm. It's beautiful. It's profound, and you know, I find, just as an aside, I find that, you know, the teachers that really do what we might call soul-centered work, you know, therapeutic work, whatever, soul-infused work, use a lot of poetry. You know, you're quoting Rilke a lot. Joanna Macy and Mary Oliver and different, you know, John O'Donohue. And so, you know, your book, which again was gifted to me by a client that I was working with, a man who's going through a breakup, just went off like a bomb inside of me in the most beautiful way. Because it connected to something that I was already waking up to, that there's so much grieving undone inside of me. So, you know, a few of the things I just want to sort of list that really opened up for me, and I have some questions around this, you know, that our grieving was never meant to be so private. Holy shit. Why is that so obvious? But yet it never occurred to me.
Well, how could it? I mean, if the context is heroic, then it has to be private.
Mm. Yeah.
Grief is one of those things that reveals the heart.
Mm.
And one of the primary, you know, principles of heroic lifestyle is keep the heart protected.
Yeah.
So we can't grieve publicly. We can't grieve in the open. I mean, that's one of the most beautiful things that happens in the initiation work and also on the retreats that I do. Is to see men holding each other as they're grieving. It's so profoundly, you know, reparative to this incredible isolation that we've been confined to, this solitary confinement, to come out of that into each other's arms and weep. Oh, it's precious.
Also, that grief unmetabolized or unacknowledged, unseen, unworked with, becomes bitter.
Yes.
That really landed for me.
Yeah, you can feel it. I mean, you can see it. It manifested. I mean, when people come to see me in my office, they often come in with this self-diagnostic process of depression.
Mm.
And what I often say to them is, sounds more like oppression, that there are layers and layers of sediment that have come into your life from untouched sorrow, untouched grief. And you can begin to feel how it begins to taint the sweetness of life into something bitter, where you begin to reject life and to pull away from life. And that's why we want to do the work of grieving, is because it's the way in which the heart is once again quickened and softened and opened. Part of why it's so hard to be a human being right now is that there's so much coming into the heart that is grieful. You know, that there's so much sorrow. And we're not wired. We're not designed to digest this much loss and grief on a day-by-day basis. So if we don't have a practice to keep that material moving, then you have to shut down.
Yeah. You
know, all praise for numbness, all praise for anesthesia. It helps us to endure, but it certainly doesn't help us to stay engaged.
I've chosen, as I think many, many men will, I've chosen a partner, in my case, a woman, an intimate, my wife, who feels deeply, cries regularly.
Yes.
She does it as a practice. She knows she needs to.
Yes.
And yet my nervous system is not so open as that. I'm in the work. I'm working on it, doing the things that I need, that I think I will be helpful. I'm still working on that. And yet I know that in my calcifying around grief, my wife doesn't get all of me in many ways. She doesn't get to feel a lot of me, and that doesn't serve us.
No, but that's very well said, and I appreciate your honesty about that. I mean, I think we have to have a tremendous amount of self-compassion for where we are. I wrote in my book, The Wildage of Sorrow, that grief work is what opens the heart to compassion for the suffering of others. But I didn't write in there is that it requires self-compassion to open to our own grief.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to actually bring enough kindness and warmth. See, when grief is not metabolized, it turns cold. It's an old alchemical idea that you have to keep the material warm for it to move. And when we neglect our grief, when we turn away from it, when we don't trust it, when we're fearful of it, those are all cold states. And so then the grief congeals and hardens, and we can feel it in our heart. When the heart becomes, why is congestive heart failure the number one cause of death? well, it isn't just, you know, French fries. It's also the fact that we have forgotten how to keep the heart emptied, open, flowing. So we have to have a great deal of compassion that this is where we start. And it isn't about pushing through the grief. It isn't about forcing it. It's about softening to the grief. That's what I call taking up the apprenticeship with sorrow. Is how do I come into a lifelong companionship that I'll never be free of grief, ever. But I'd also, what I want is to have an ongoing living friendship with grief, as if it's the companion walking alongside me every day, which puts me then in terms of the bittersweet. That's the full measure. If I deny grief, I turn bitter. If I can companion grief, I can remember the bittersweet, which is a deepening and a ripening. And I think that's what leads to elderhood in the long run. As someone who is not afraid to keep digesting the material of the world, the losses and tragedies and traumas of the world, because that person cannot simultaneously see the sweetness, the beauty, the exquisite elegance of this world is not lost on someone who has done that work.
Well, you quote a Rilke, I mean, the depths of it, that you quote Rilke in your book, be ahead of all parting as if it has already happened.
Yeah.
And I remember an experience when I was probably 20 years old. It was my last year of college in Arizona, and I was sitting on top this rock with my girlfriend in college. And I remember distinctly realizing, it's probably the first time I was consciously aware that this moment is going to end. This is going to come and go in a blink of an eye. So better kind of lock it in. I remember feeling the wind on my skin, feeling, I mean, it's so visceral even now because I was so aware of the moment's passing. But what I'm also aware of, and that's something that I've held with me throughout the years, that even before our conversation, for instance, there was a moment I was feeling grief. I was grieving and I was sad. Because I've been so excited for this, and I'm like, okay, we're gonna have this moment, and then this is gonna pass. And there was a heartbreak in that. I think, but in the past, and even perhaps now, there's a part of me that still just wants to bypass that grief. Yeah. Life goes on. You know, suck it up.
At what cost, Brian?
My vitality. But yeah, I'm sure I don't even really know the full answer to that question.
Yeah. To bypass the grief is what keeps the heart congested. I mean, I remember I was driving back from a men's retreat once with a friend of mine, and he just kind of quipped to me, so Francis, are you happy? And I said, I have moments of being happy, but I also have moments of being sad and lonely and angry and, you know, heartbroken. And I said, I've stopped trying to be happy because I realized every time I didn't make it, I thought I was failing. Because we're a happiness culture.
Yeah.
So, but what I want is to be alive. And every one of those feelings has vitality in them. When I'm in my grief, I am fully alive. Grief, it cannot be domesticated. It is a wild creature. And you cannot. The only thing you can do is try to avoid it. You know, and that's that state that you just described, trying to bypass the grief. But that means my own aliveness, my own vitality, as you say, will be compromised and I will become smaller.
Yeah.
You know, the circumference of my life will continue to diminish. That's where I was when I was 40 years old, refusing to enter into the messiness of those things. Grief is always there.
Something else that also was just a revelation for me was that grief needs to properly or genuinely grieve, we need containment and release.
Yes.
This again blew up in me, Francis, because I realized, and you said this, you can't release your grief. It's not an exact paraphrasing, but you can't release grief if you're also being the container for it. I have been the container for my own grief forever.
Right.
Even as a child, the things that were happening to me, nobody ever really, except, you know, maybe a cousin died. And okay, so my dad held me and let me cry that out. But that's kind of it. all the other things I was going through that were happening, experiencing, mm-hmm. nobody held a container for that. And so I conditioned, my body became conditioned to be its own container. No fucking wonder.
No.
I, to this day, it's a challenge for me to just let myself cry during a movie.
Yeah, those two requirements. Again, if we go back to the heroic model, and you're not allowed to ask for that support, mm-hmm. you become what I call a continuous you recycle grief over and over again. You're just chewing the same bones, the same pieces are just tumbling through there over and over again, and there's no release, because in order for release to occur, you have to be held and do mm-hmm. one job, mm-hmm. which is to be the one doing the work. That's why you don't see in traditional cultures solitary grief work. It's always communal. Now, I can't tell you how many times after a grief ritual is over, we spend usually 3 or 4 days together, at the end of it, someone will speak up and say, I've never done anything like this before. This was so beyond anything I've ever done. But then they'll say something like, but it felt oddly familiar. Mm-hmm. And that's the deep memory echo. That's beyond the amnesia.
Yeah.
There's a thing Jung said, we have an unforgotten wisdom at the core of the psyche. So in the unforgotten wisdom, we remember this. That's why when we're in that space, the psyche perks up, soul perks up and goes, that's what I've been waiting for. This is it. Mm-hmm. I've been waiting to be in circle and singing and kneeling side by side and having the shrine and everyone kind of collaboratively entering into the well of sorrow together. And my God, does the grief flow then. But I also just say, in all honesty, and I think I've said this before in other contexts, that it took me 3 grief rituals before I shed my first tear. Mm-hmm. I was a very well-packed white man, mm-hmm. In control, in control. Mm-hmm. And I thought the third time was going to be the same story. But then someone I knew and trusted came along and put their hand on my shoulder. And I looked at them and I saw something in their eyes, and then I was on the floor for 3 hours. And then that well finally broke open, or that dam finally broke. Now tears are a very frequent guest in my house.
In my last, the men's retreat I did for my Elevate 2021 group back in August, we did 5 days together, and we'd been working with each other for already 7-8 months by this time. And me and my partner Tate, we're holding the container for that experience. We're the facilitators, we're the container holders for these 10 men. And I remember at the very last day, we do all the stuff we do. And at the end, the men want to honor Tate and I. They want to put us in the middle of the circle and put their hands on us and speak into us. And I remember in that moment, there was no why for it. All of a sudden, my body just burst into tears, sobbing, the shoulders and the whole body just, something about just in that moment being held by these men.
Yeah.
I've asked my friends, a men's group that I've been in for a few years where, we're all in it together. I'm not facilitating it. No one's facilitating it. It's just our men's group. I've asked them all just in the last few weeks. I said, guys, I want to start doing monthly, and I'm hesitant to use the word, but grieving circles. And I'm hesitant to use the word only because I have that story that the only people who are going to show up are the people who believe they have something to grieve, something big happened, a death or a breakup, something obvious. And I'm realizing that there's so much to grieve. I want to just talk about loss. And you've shared this in some of your how do you get started doing this? I want to start leading these monthly, at least monthly circles where we just talk about loss and sorrow. How would you suggest I start a conversation like that with, and by the way, even the fumbly way I've done it, all my friends are in, they all get it. We all know. We talk about this. This is a real good group of men. We know. We see. Just no one's brought that up yet, and I'm bringing it up, and so they're in.
Well, thank you for doing that. I think most of us are just waiting for permission.
Yeah.
I think there's such a prohibition against entering into that room. There's also a fear of entering that room.
Definitely. But
one of the things, you know, before you get too far into it, is talk about fear. Talk about, you know, why are we so hesitant to open this door? And if, like you said before, many of us did not have our grief held when we were young. So we don't feel like there's a bottom to it. So when we get into that territory, we feel like we're in free fall.
Yeah.
But part of why it's so valuable to do this in a group context is we begin to have faith in grief again, that it's not there to take me hostage. It's actually there to ripen me and make my heart more elastic and capable of holding not only my grief, but your grief and the children's grief and the salmon's grief and the complexity of grief. And I think it's good to talk about the five gates.
Yeah.
You know, because we do only think of grief primarily in terms of losing someone we love or a marriage ending or people will then say, I'm really sorry about your loss. But the other four gates, you know, about personal losses to our integrity, you know, pieces of me that have to go into hiding and, you know, my shame, my feelings of worthlessness, my weakness, all those outcast brothers, I call them. That's a loss. That's a loss to my wholeness. And every loss is worthy of grieving, but I can't grieve them because I hold them with contempt. So part of the grief work oftentimes in that second gate is, and that's what therapy is about, is kind of bringing in the outcasts in a way that we can grieve their absence for sometimes for a lifetime. And then we talk about the third gate, which is the sorrows of the world. And who doesn't know the sorrows of the world right now?
Yeah.
As you say, you look out your window into LA and you're looking into the belly of the sorrow. You know, whether it's the quality of the air or the homeless or the rapacious consumption or you know, the silencing of languages, the abuse to people of color. I mean, there's so much sorrow in the world. And part of our work is to come out of the fantasy that I'm separate from that. We feel it in our tissue every day. And so we need places to talk about that. And then the fourth gate is what we expected and did not receive. This is the amnesia piece. That we're wired for the entire spectrum of experiences that our deep time ancestors had, of village life, of tribal life. And I mean, that's in our DNA.
Yeah.
Both physiologically, but also psychologically, I think spiritually as well, that we expected to see 40 pairs of eyes looking back at us and seeing us and welcoming us and having belonging just kind of rooted in the bone so that I don't, I'm not anxious about that for the rest of my life. And then the last gate I call the ancestral grief, which has so much complexity to it as I sit with that one. The more I sit with that gate, the more I realize I think all grief is ancestral grief in the sense that, yes, if I have a wound around shame, which is my wound, well, where did that come from? Why did my family in some ways activate that wound if they themselves did not also know that wound? And how many generations back can I go to where the silencing of affection, demonstrations of love got nullified? How many generations back can I go? I can go back pretty many, you know, when that wound began, or the, you know, the lingering issues that we hold collectively around what happened to the native cultures when white European people arrived here and then the importation of slavery. And we have still not even begun to scratch that grief collectively.
Yeah.
So we're haunted by that unmetabolized sorrow. We are haunted by it every day through racial killing and, you know, economic injustices. I mean, that it is a lingering grief. So when someone says, I don't have much to grieve, bullshit. You have too much to grieve.
I remember when Obama was elected, I was surprised to see, I mean, I voted for him. I was excited. I hoped he would win. But and when he won, I remember I felt lighter in a way that no other election is at. Well, that's maybe the last one a little bit. And yet, boy, that's gone away.
Yeah. Yeah, we see the backlash. I mean, we're entering a period, what I call the long dark, which will be decades and decades, perhaps generations, multiple generations, where we are not going to see a whole lot of rising. We are in a time of deep descent in both senses of that word. A lot of descent is happening right now. A lot of no is being spoken, but we're also in a trajectory downward. And this is a necessary descent, because in the old alchemical language, this is the period of the negredo, the blackening. And in the blackening, that is the beginning process of shedding old structures, old paradigms, old ideologies, old things that do not sustain life. So we have to look at systemic racism and economic injustice, and we have to look at what's happening to our ecological systems. That's such a cold term, to look at what's happening to grizzly bears and glaciers and, you know, the fact that here in California, we have almost no water left. This is not something abstract.
Yeah.
This is immediate and in our flesh and in our bones. So this is right now. We have to deal with this now. And this is the long dark. This is going to take a long, long period. I just wrote the preface for a new book that's coming out by Dwayne Elgin called Choosing Earth.
Oh, great.
It was the most difficult piece I've ever had to write after reading his book and looking at what's coming in the 2030s, 2040s, 2050s and beyond. It's scary. And we don't know if we're going to make it. But this planetary initiation, if we can make it, may offer something to those generations, perhaps not even born yet, that might begin to resemble what living culture looks like again. If we do the work now, we are planting seeds. I often say, I'm not going to see that. I'm not going to see that. I'm just about 66 years old. I'm not going to see that sunrise.
Yeah.
But I can plant seeds now in the dark that when there is enough moisture and enough light, those seeds might emerge into something that can sustain life again. That's my job. That's your job. That's every man who listens to this podcast job. It isn't about my future, my benefit, but it's living for those who dream about being here.
You and I are perfectly in sync, because this is exactly where I was going, my next question, and really leading into the conclusion of our conversation. You use the term the long dark. I've heard you also use the term a rough initiation.
Yes.
You've also said, you know, the question that I was wanting to ask you about this, about, and, you know, I have it right here in my notes, that may last decades, if not generations. And you just, you know, right, you and I are in sync, just in terms of the flow of our conversation as well. And you know, I've for most of my life, I've been a fairly optimistic man. Maybe it's more of the heroic influence that I, you know, that I couched in optimism. But I would say probably for the first time in my life, I do at times feel deeply, deeply scared of what's coming. It's no longer kind of an abstract idea, climate change particularly. I mean, I live in California too. I mean, you know, there was a month out of last year when we couldn't really breathe the air here very safely because of the fires.
Yes, here too.
And we're still pretty lucky. I mean, you know, other places in the world, they're already losing their homes for climate reasons.
Right.
And I've heard you say something really beautiful about this as I reflect on, you know, how to hold this. I heard you say, there is no answer, but there is a response.
Yes.
Could you speak more to that?
Yeah. I was speaking up in Victoria, Canada, about all of the things we're talking about to some degree, maybe not quite as deeply, but, and then a very young woman raised her hand and says, so what is the answer? How are we going to fix this? I said, there is no answer, but there is a response. And every one of us must decipher the response you are being asked to make and then to make it. Individually, I can't do a damn thing. Collectively, we might have enough care and enough courage to respond boldly enough to preserve something in the dark. You know, there's a term out of the Inuit culture called kartsiluni. The word translates something like sitting alone together quietly in the dark, waiting expectantly for something to occur. That's where we are right now. So we have to somehow let go of the fiction of fixing things, because I think that comes out of the same mindset that created the problem. We're going to have to go into dreaming, into the imagination, into the darkness, into the land below the land, into that underworld place, and be dreamt into something. We can't figure our way out of this. It's going to require a completely different way of imagining what is happening for us right now. I often say this is a time of courage and faith. Courage to keep our hearts open, and faith that there's something intelligible about what is happening. Something intelligible. And if we listen, see, this is a time of humility, a time of deep listening, a time of not knowing. We don't know what the hell's happening. We're watching what some people call the great unraveling. Things are just falling apart. And they need to. They need to. Because what we've created is absolutely and utterly unsustainable for this planet.
Yeah.
So those structures have to fall apart. And that's scary because we rely upon those structures.
Yeah.
We don't know what we're going to do without those structures. But this is where the return to living culture becomes so crucial. To gather in small circles of people, to sing again, to weep, to have rituals dreamt into our bones again that might suture the tear between our psyches and the soul of the world, so we can come back into some kind of reciprocal relationship with her in a way that does not cause permanent damage, but that we're actually beginning to put something back into her body. And stop the great extraction.
Do you have hope for us, humanity anyway?
It doesn't matter whether I have hope or not. It would not change my behavior. No.
Like that, yeah.
I don't know. But I have two grandchildren. That brings tears. I have two grandchildren. What am I supposed to do? What if I'm hopeless? Does that mean I stop acting? Does that mean I stop talking and doing the things that I've been called to do? Hell no.
Yeah.
I have to continue to do whatever I'm doing that I feel called. My response. I have to have fidelity to my response. And I will do that until my last breath. And I don't know when that's going to be. Many, many fewer days ahead of me than behind me. That's for sure.
Yeah.
But I want them to be days that feed the body of the world. And hopefully my grandchildren will have something that endures. That's my act of love.
Last question. And I'm just so grateful for our conversation today. For our listener, and again, we have women and men listen to this, but my intention for this podcast is to speak to men specifically. So what would you say? And you may have already said it, but I'd like to ask this question as a sort of a final question. What would you say is the biggest challenge facing a man today? And what one piece of wisdom might you offer in the face of it?
I mean, we've said it, I think, many different ways, but the primary challenge is the fiction of separation, the idea of individual salvation, the idea of individual perfection, the idea of somehow the primary purpose of life is to fool the world into thinking you're somehow special. So what advice? I would just invite the men to become transparently vulnerable. Remember that feeling you had a little while ago when we talked about becoming an ordinary man and the relief that fell on your shoulders? I would pray for that for every man. Because then we can make this pivot away from trying to impress to trying to participate. There's a way in which we are so preoccupied by self-obsession because we're so anxious about our place in the world. If we could grant that to each other. See, there's a real important piece here around we're always looking for belonging, right?
Yeah.
We're always trying to find those little places of belonging. Well, at some point, at least by 40 or so, at least by 47, you need to stop looking for them and become one. You need to become a house of belonging.
Yeah.
You see other people around you who feel lost and bewildered and disconnected and alienated. and offer them a place of shelter. Two things happens. One of them is that that person begins to feel at home in the world, and who knows what gifts they might be able to share then. And you, by the very act of making a home, become a place where you know belonging. So I would invite your listeners to do that as well. Yeah.
I think that's probably the core intention, even of my Elevate program. You know, I know we use that language, but you know, I don't promise men that they're going to make more money, that they're going to succeed in any different, you know, in any external way. I don't personally give a shit about any of those things. I think, and I don't know, maybe we haven't articulated it so much like this, but it's creating a house of belonging for men. Yeah. In the individual heroic world, that to me has been the greatest gift to myself of regularly gathering with men in this way.
Beautiful.
So I love that. Thank you for that. Francis, where can our listeners, and I'm going to just, you know, keep promoting the heck out of you and your work, and I'll, you know, everything I can do to help people discover you, I'm going to do, but where would you like our listeners to go to learn more about what you're up to right now?
The easiest thing is just francisweller.net. That's my primary website. And that's where you can find, we're not doing a lot right now, program wise, mm-hmm. most of it's all online, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of resources in there for programs that we have done that have been recorded that are available. And I mean, everything I'm doing, every piece that you've listened to around the recordings has one primary intention, which is to grow us up, you know, to get us outside of that adolescent obsession and begin to show up as robust adults in the world so that the world might stand a chance. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I am all in, sir. I'm all in with you. I am all in for you and for us.
Yes.
I am so profoundly grateful for this conversation, for you saying yes, for you offering your time and your insight and your presence and your wisdom and your graciousness. And thank you so much.
You're welcome, Brian. We might just have to do this again.
Will I? Yes. Thank you, sir.